Evidence suggests that unlearning existing memories is necessary to make room for new memories in our networks. Unlearning is essential when we are moving from one developmental stage to the next. When at the end of adolescence a girl leaves home to go to college in another state, for example, both she and her parents undergo grief and massive plastic change as they alter old emotional habits, routines, and self-images. Falling in love for the first time also means entering a new developmental stage and demands a massive amount of unlearning. When people commit to each other, they must radically alter their existing and often selfish intentions and modify all other attachments in order to integrate the new person in their lives. Life now involves ongoing cooperation that requires a plastic reorganization of the brain centers that deal with emotions, sexuality, and the self. Millions of neural networks have to be obliterated and replaced with new ones, one reason that falling in love feels for so many people like a loss of identity. Falling in love may also mean falling out of love with a past love. This, too, requires unlearning at a neural level. A man's heart is broken by his first love when his engagement breaks off. He looks at many women, but each pales in comparison to the fiancée he came to believe was his one true love and whose image haunts him. He cannot unlearn the pattern of attraction to his first love. Or a woman married for 20 years becomes a young widow and refuses to date. She cannot imagine she will ever fall in love again, and the idea of replacing her husband offends her. Years pass, and her friends tell her it is time to move on, to no avail. Often such people cannot move on because they cannot yet grieve. The thought of living without the one they love is too painful to bear. In neuroplastic terms, if the romantic or the widow is to begin a new relationship without baggage, each must first rewire billions of connections in their brains. The work of mourning is piecemeal, Freud noted. Though reality tells us our loved one is gone, its orders cannot be obeyed at once. We grieve by calling up one memory at a time, reliving it, and then letting it go. At a brain level, we are turning on each of the neural networks that were wired together to form our perception of the person, experiencing the memory with exceptional vividness, then saying goodbye one network at a time. In grief, we learn to live without the one we love, but the reason this lesson is so hard is that we first must unlearn the idea that the person exists and can still be relied on. Walter J. Freeman, a professor of neuroscience at Berkeley, was the first to argue that there is a connection between love and massive unlearning. He has assembled a number of compelling biological facts that point toward the conclusion that massive neuronal reorganization occurs at two life stages, when we fall in love and when we begin parenting. Freeman argues that massive plastic brain reorganization, far more massive than in normal learning or unlearning, becomes possible because of a brain neuromodulator. Neuromodulators are different from neurotransmitters. While neurotransmitters are released in the synapses to excite or inhibit neurons, neuromodulators enhance or diminish the overall effectiveness of the synaptic connections and bring about enduring change. Freeman believes that when we commit in love, the brain neuromodulator oxytocin is released, allowing existing neuronal connections to melt away so that changes on a large scale can follow. Oxytocin is sometimes called the commitment neuromodulator because it reinforces bonding in mammals. It is released when lovers connect and make love. In humans, oxytocin is released in both sexes during orgasm and when couples parent and nurture their children. In women, oxytocin is released during labor and breastfeeding. An fMRI study shows that when mothers look at photos of their children, brain regions rich in oxytocin are activated. In male mammals, a closely related neuromodulator called vasopressin is released when they become fathers. Many young people who doubt they will be able to handle the responsibilities of parenting are not aware of the extent to which oxytocin may change their brains, allowing them to rise to the occasion. Studies of a monogamous animal called the prairie vole have shown that oxytocin, which is normally released in their brains during mating, makes them pair off for life. If a female vole has oxytocin injected into her brain, she will pair bond for life with a nearby male. If a male vole is injected with vasopressin, it will cuddle with a nearby female. Oxytocin appears also to attach children to parents, and the neurons that control its secretion may have a critical period of their own. Children reared in orphanages without close loving contact often have bonding problems when older. Their oxytocin levels remain low for several years after they have been adopted by loving families. Whereas dopamine induces excitement, puts us into high gear, and triggers sexual arousal, oxytocin induces a calm, warm mood that increases tender feelings and attachment, and may lead us to lower our guard. A recent study shows that oxytocin also triggers trust. When people sniff oxytocin and then participate in a financial game, they are more prone to trust others with their money. Though there is still more work to be done on oxytocin in humans, evidence suggests that its effect is similar to that in prairie voles. It makes us commit to our partners and devotes us to our children. But oxytocin, Freeman argues, works in a unique way, related to unlearning. In sheep, oxytocin is released in the olfactory bulb, a part of the brain involved in odor perception, with each new litter. Sheep and many other animals bond with or imprint on their offspring by scent. They mother their own lambs and reject the unfamiliar. But if oxytocin is injected into a mother ewe when exposed to an unfamiliar lamb, she will mother the strange lamb too. Oxytocin is not, however, released with the first litter, only with those litters that follow, suggesting to Freeman that the oxytocin plays the role of wiping out the neural circuits that bonded the mother with her first litter so she can bond with her second. Freeman suspects that the mother bonds with her first litter using other neurochemicals. Oxytocin's ability to wipe out learned behavior has led some scientists to call it an amnestic hormone. Freeman proposes that oxytocin melts down existing neuronal connections that underlie existing attachments, so new attachments can be formed. Oxytocin, in this theory, does not teach parents to parent, nor does it make lovers cooperative and kind. Rather, it makes it possible for them to learn new patterns. There is some dispute over the idea that oxytocin is solely responsible for this new burst of learning, for changes in our existing attachments, or how it might facilitate these changes. Neuroscientist Jacques Ponskiep argues that oxytocin, in combination with other brain chemicals, is so overwhelmingly good at reducing our feelings of separation distress that the pain of losing previous attachments makes less of an impression than it would otherwise. This relative lack of distress may also free us to learn new things and form new bonds while partially reconfiguring our existing relationships. Freeman's theory helps to explain how love and plasticity affect each other. Plasticity allows us to develop brains so unique in response to our individual life experiences that it is often hard to see the world as others do, to want what they want, or to cooperate. But the successful reproduction of our species requires cooperation. What nature provides in a neuromodulator like oxytocin is the ability for two brains in love to go through a period of heightened plasticity, allowing them to mold to each other and shape each other's intentions and perceptions. The brain for Freeman is fundamentally an organ of socialization, and so there must be a mechanism that, from time to time, undoes our tendency to become overly individualized, overly self-involved, and too self-centered. As Freeman says, the deepest meaning of sexual experience lies not in pleasure or even in reproduction, but in the opportunity it affords to surmount the solipsistic gulf, opening the door, so to speak, whether or not one undertakes the work to go through. It is the afterplay, not the foreplay, that counts in building trust. Freeman's concept reminds us of many variations on love. The insecure man who leaves a woman quickly after making love during the night because he fears being overly influenced by her, should he stay through the morning. The woman who tends to fall in love with whomever she has sex with. Or the sudden transformation of the man who barely noticed children into a devoted father. We say, he's matured, and the kids come first, but he may have had some help from oxytocin, which allowed him to go beyond his deep-seated patterns of selfish concern. Contrast him with the inveterate bachelor who never falls in love and becomes more eccentric and rigid with each passing year, plastically reinforcing his routines through repetition. Unlearning in love allows us to change our image of ourselves, for the better, if we have an adoring partner. But it also helps account for our vulnerability when we fall in love and explains why so many self-possessed young men and women who fall in love with a manipulative, undermining, or devaluing person often lose all sense of self and become plagued with self-doubt, from which it may take years to recover. Understanding unlearning and some of the fine points of brain plasticity turned out to be crucial in the treatment of my patient A. By the time A went to college, he found himself replaying his critical period experience and being attracted to emotionally disturbed, already attached women very much like his mother, feeling it was his job to love and rescue them. A was caught in two plastic traps. The first was that a relationship with a thoughtful, stable woman who might have helped him unlearn his love for problem women and teach him a new way to love simply didn't turn him on, though he wished it would. So he was stuck with a destructive attraction formed in his critical period. His second related trap can also be understood plastically. One of his most tormenting symptoms was the almost perfect fusion in his mind of sex with aggression. He felt that to love someone was to consume her, to eat her alive, and that to be loved was to be eaten alive. And his feeling that sexual intercourse was a violent act upset him greatly, yet excited him. Thoughts of sexual intercourse immediately led to thoughts of violence, and thoughts of violence to sex. When he was effective sexually, he felt he was dangerous. It was as though he lacked separate brain maps for sexual and violent feelings. Mrzenik has described a number of brain traps that occur when two brain maps, meant to be separate, merge. As we have seen, he found that if a monkey's fingers were sewn together and so forced to move at the same time, the maps for them would fuse, because their neurons fired together and hence wired together. But he also discovered that maps fuse in everyday life. When a musician uses two fingers together frequently enough while playing an instrument, the maps for the two fingers sometimes fuse, and when the musician tries to move only one finger, the other moves too. The maps for the two different fingers are now de-differentiated. The more intensely the musician tries to produce a single movement, the more he will move both fingers, strengthening the merged map. The harder the person tries to get out of the brain trap, the deeper he gets into it, developing a condition called focal dystonia. A similar brain trap occurs in Japanese people who, when speaking English, can't hear the difference between R and L, because the two sounds are not differentiated in their brain maps. Each time they try to say the sounds properly, they say them incorrectly, reinforcing the problem. This is what I believe A experienced. Each time he thought of sex, he thought of violence. Each time he thought of violence, he thought of sex, reinforcing the connection in the merged map. Mrzenik's colleague Nancy Bile, who works in physical medicine, teaches people who can't control their fingers to re-differentiate their finger maps. The trick is not to try to move the fingers separately, but to relearn how to use their hands the way they did as babies. When treating guitarists with focal dystonias who have lost control of their fingers, for example, she first instructs them to stop playing guitar for a while to weaken the merged map. Then they just hold an unstrung guitar for a few days. Then a single string with a different feel from a normal guitar string is put on the guitar, and they feel it carefully, but with only one finger. Finally, they use a second finger on a separate string. Eventually, the fused brain maps for their fingers separate into two distinct maps, and they can play again. A came into psychoanalysis. Early on, we sorted out why love and aggression had fused, tracing the roots of his brain trap to his experience with his drunken mother, who often gave free rein to sexual and violent feelings simultaneously. But when he still couldn't change what attracted him, I did something similar to what Mrzenik and Bile do to redifferentiate maps. For a long period in the therapy, whenever A expressed any kind of physical tenderness outside the sexual arena, untainted by aggression, I pointed it out and asked him to observe it closely, reminding him that he was capable of a positive feeling and capable of intimacy. When violent thoughts came up, I got him to search his experience to find even a single instance in which aggression or violence was untainted with sex, or was even praiseworthy, as in justified self-defense. Whenever these areas came up, a pure physical tenderness or aggression that wasn't destructive, I drew his attention to them. As time passed, he was able to form two different brain maps, one for physical tenderness, which had nothing to do with the seductiveness he experienced with his mother, and another for aggression, including healthy assertiveness, which was quite different from the senseless violence he'd experienced when his mother was drunk. Separating sex and violence in his brain maps allowed him to feel better about relationships and sex, and improvement followed in stages. While he wasn't immediately able to fall in love with or become excited by a healthy woman, he did fall in love with a woman who was a bit healthier than his previous girlfriend, and he benefited from the learning and unlearning that love provided. This experience allowed him to enter progressively healthier relationships, unlearning more each time. By the end of therapy, he was in a healthy, satisfying, happy marriage. His character and his sexual type had been radically transformed. The rewiring of our pleasure systems and the extent to which our sexual tastes can be acquired is seen most dramatically in such perversions as sexual masochism, which turns physical pain into sexual pleasure. To do this, the brain must make pleasant that which is inherently unpleasant, and the impulses that normally trigger our pain system are plastically rewired into our pleasure system. People with perversions often organize their lives around activities that mix aggression and sexuality, and they often celebrate and idealize humiliation, hostility, defiance, the forbidden, the furtive, the lusciously sinful, and the breaking of taboos. They feel special for not being merely normal. These transgressive or defiant attitudes are essential to the enjoyment of perversion. The idealization of the perverse and the devaluation of normalcy is brilliantly captured in Vladimir Nabokov's novel Lolita, in which a middle-aged man idolizes and has sex with a prepubescent 12-year-old girl while showing contempt for all older females. Sexual sadism illustrates plasticity in that it fuses two familiar tendencies, the sexual and the aggressive, each of which can give pleasure separately, and brings them together so when they are discharged, the pleasure is doubled. But masochism goes much further because it takes something inherently unpleasant, pain, and turns it into a pleasure, altering the sexual drive more fundamentally and more vividly demonstrating the plasticity of our pleasure and pain systems. For years, the police, through raids on S&M establishments, knew more about serious perversions than most clinicians. While patients with milder perversions often come for treatment of such problems as anxiety or depression, those with serious perversions seldom seek therapy because generally they enjoy them. Robert Stoller, M.D., a California psychoanalyst, did make important discoveries through visits to S&M and B&D, bondage and discipline establishments, in Los Angeles. He interviewed people who practiced hardcore sadomasochism, which inflicts real pain on the flesh, and discovered that masochistic participants had all had serious physical illnesses as children and had undergone regular, terrifying, painful medical treatments. As a result, writes Stoller, they had to be confined severely and for long periods in hospitals without the chance to unload their frustration, despair, and rage openly and appropriately. Hence, the perversions. As children, they consciously took their pain, their inexpressible rage, and reworked it in daydreams and altered mental states or in masturbation fantasies so they could replay the story of the trauma with a happy ending and say to themselves, "This time I win." And the way they won was by eroticizing their agony. The idea that an inherently painful feeling can become pleasurable may at first strike us as hard to believe, because we tend to assume that each of our sensations and emotions is inherently either pleasurable, joy, triumph, and sexual pleasure, or painful, sadness, fear, and grief. But in fact, this assumption does not hold up. We can cry tears of happiness and have bittersweet triumphs. And in neuroses, people may feel guilty about sexual pleasure or no pleasure at all, where others would feel delight. An emotion that we think inherently unpleasurable, such as sadness, can, if beautifully and subtly articulated in music, literature, or art, feel not only poignant, but sublime. Fear can be exciting in frightening movies or on roller coasters. The human brain seems able to attach many of our feelings and sensations either to the pleasure system or to the pain system, and each of these links or mental associations requires a novel plastic connection in the brain. The hardcore masochists whom Stoller interviewed must have formed a pathway that linked the painful sensations they had endured to their sexual pleasure systems, resulting in a new composite experience, voluptuous pain. That they all suffered in early childhood strongly suggests that this rewiring occurred during the critical periods of sexual plasticity. In 1997, a documentary appeared that sheds light on plasticity and masochism. Sick: The Life and Death of Bob Flanagan, Super Masochist. Bob Flanagan performed his masochistic acts in public as a performance artist and exhibitionist, and was articulate, poetic, and at times very funny. In Flanagan's opening scenes, we see him naked, humiliated, pies being thrown in his face, fed with a funnel. But images flash of his being physically hurt and choked, hinting at far more disturbing forms of pain. Bob was born in 1952 with cystic fibrosis, a genetic disorder of the lungs and pancreas in which the body produces an excessive amount of abnormally thick mucus that clogs the air passages, making it impossible to breathe normally and leads to chronic digestive problems. He had to fight for every breath and often turned blue from lack of oxygen. Most patients born with this disease die as children or in their early 20s. Bob's parents noticed he was in pain from the moment he came home from the hospital. When he was 18 months old, doctors discovered pus between his lungs and began treating him by inserting needles deep into his chest. He began to dread these procedures and screamed desperately. Throughout childhood, he was hospitalized regularly and confined nearly naked inside a bubble-like tent so doctors could monitor his sweat. One of the ways cystic fibrosis is diagnosed, while he felt mortified that his body was visible to strangers. To help him breathe and fight infections, doctors inserted all sorts of tubes into him. He was also aware of the severity of his problem. Two of his younger sisters had also had cystic fibrosis. One died at 6 months, the other at 21 years. Despite the fact that he had become a poster boy for the Orange County Cystic Fibrosis Society, he began to live a secret life. As a young child, when his stomach hurt relentlessly, he would stimulate his penis to distract himself. By the time he was in high school, he would lie naked at night and secretly cover himself with thick glue, for he knew not what reason. He hung himself from a door with belts in painful positions. Then he began to insert needles into the belts to pierce his flesh. When he was 31, he fell in love with Cherie Rose, who came from a very troubled family. In the film, we see Cherie's mother openly belittle her husband, Cherie's father, who, Cherie claims, was passive and never showed her affection. Cherie describes herself as being bossy since childhood. She is Bob's sadist. In the film, Cherie uses Bob, with his consent, as her slave. She humiliates him, cuts into the skin near his nipples with an X-Acto knife, puts clamps on his nipples, force feeds him, chokes him with a cord till he turns blue, forces a large steel ball as big as a billiard ball into his anus, and puts needles in his erogenous zones. His mouth and lips are sutured shut with stitches. He writes of drinking Cherie's urine from a baby bottle. We see him with feces on his penis. His every orifice is invaded or defiled. These activities give Bob erections and lead to great orgasms in the sex that often follows. Bob survives both his 20s and his 30s, and in his early 40s has become the oldest living survivor of cystic fibrosis. He takes his masochism on the road to S&M clubs and art museums, where he enacts his masochistic rituals in public, always wearing his oxygen mask to breathe. In one of the final scenes, a naked Bob Flanagan takes a hammer and nails his penis right through its center to a board. He then matter-of-factly removes the nails so that blood spurts all over the camera lens like a fountain from the deep hole through his penis. It is important to describe precisely what Flanagan's nervous system could endure in order to understand the extent to which completely novel brain circuits can develop, linking the pain system to the pleasure system. Flanagan's idea that his pain must be made pleasurable colored his fantasies from early childhood. His remarkable history confirms that his perversion developed out of his unique life experience and is linked to his traumatic memories. As an infant, he was tied into the crib in the hospital so he couldn't escape and hurt himself. By age 7, his confinement had turned into a love of constriction. As an adult, he loved bondage and being handcuffed or tied up and hung for long periods in positions that torturers might use to break their victims. As a child, he was required to endure the powerful nurses and doctors who hurt him. As an adult, he voluntarily gave this power to Cherie, becoming her slave, whom she could abuse while practicing pseudo-medical procedures on him. Even subtle aspects of his childhood relationship to his doctors were repeated in adulthood. The fact that Bob gave Cherie his consent repeated an aspect of the trauma because after a certain age, when the doctors took blood, pierced his skin, and hurt him, he gave them permission, knowing his life depended on it. This mirroring of childhood traumas through the repetition of such subtle details is typical of perversions. Fetishists, who are attracted to objects, have the same trait. A fetish, Robert Stoller said, is an object that tells a story that captures scenes from childhood trauma and eroticizes them. One man who developed a fetish for rubber underwear and raincoats was a childhood bedwetter, forced to sleep on rubber sheets, which he found humiliating and uncomfortable. Flanagan had a number of fetishes for medical paraphernalia and the blunt metals from hardware stores, screws, nails, clamps, and hammers, all of which he used at various times for erotic masochistic stimulation to penetrate, pinch, or pound his flesh. Flanagan's pleasure centers were no doubt rewired in two ways. First, emotions such as anxiety that are normally unpleasant became pleasant. He explains that he is constantly flirting with death because he was promised an early death and is trying to master his fear. In his 1985 poem, Why, he makes clear that his supermasochism allows him to feel triumphant, courageous, and invulnerable after a life of vulnerability. But he goes beyond simply mastering fear. Humiliated by doctors who stripped him and put him in a plastic tent to measure his sweat, he now proudly strips in museums. To master his feelings of being exposed and humiliated as a child, he becomes a triumphant exhibitionist. Shame is made into a pleasure, converted into shamelessness. The second aspect of his rewiring is that physical pain becomes pleasure. Metal in flesh now feels good, gives him erections, and makes him have orgasms. Some people under great physical stress release endorphins, the opium-like analgesics that our bodies make to dull our pain and that can make us euphoric. But Flanagan explains he is not dulled to pain. He is drawn to it. The more he hurts himself, the more sensitized to pain he becomes, and the more pain he feels. Because his pain and pleasure systems are connected, Flanagan feels real, intense pain, and it feels good. Children are born helpless and will, in the critical period of sexual plasticity, do anything to avoid abandonment and to stay attached to adults, even if they must learn to love the pain and trauma that adults inflict. The adults in Little Bob's world inflicted pain on him for his own good. Now, by becoming a supermasochist, he ironically treats pain as though it is good for him. He is utterly aware that he is stuck in the past, reliving infancy, and says he hurts himself because I am a big baby and I want to stay that way. Perhaps the fantasy of staying the tortured baby is an imaginary way of keeping himself from the death that awaits him should he allow himself to grow up. If he can stay Peter Pan, endlessly tormented by Cherie, at least he will never grow up and die prematurely. At the end of the film, we see Flanagan dying. He stops making jokes and begins to look like a cornered animal, overwhelmed with fear. The viewer sees how terrified he must have been as a little boy before he discovered the masochistic solution to tame his pain and terror. At this point, we learn from Bob that Cherie has been talking of splitting up, evoking every suffering child's worst fear, abandonment. Cherie says the problem is that Bob is no longer submitting to her. He looks utterly brokenhearted, and in the end, she stays and nurses him tenderly. In his final moments, almost in shock, he asks plaintively, "Am I dying? I don't understand it. What is going on? I'd never believe this." So powerful were his masochistic fantasies, games, and rituals, in which he embraced painful death, that it seems he thought he had actually beaten it. As for the patients who became involved in porn, most were able to go cold turkey once they understood the problem and how they were plastically reinforcing it. They found eventually that they were attracted once again to their mates. None of these men had addictive personalities or serious childhood traumas, and when they understood what was happening to them, they stopped using their computers for a period to weaken their problematic neuronal networks, and their appetite for porn withered away. Their treatment for sexual tastes acquired later in life was far simpler than that for patients who, in their critical periods, acquired a preference for problematic sexual types. Yet even some of these men were able, like A, to change their sexual type because the same laws of neuroplasticity that allow us to acquire problematic tastes also allow us, in intensive treatment, to acquire newer, healthier ones, and in some cases even to lose our older, troubling ones. It's a use-it-or-lose-it brain, even where sexual desire and love are concerned. Chapter 5. Midnight Resurrections. Stroke victims learn to move and speak again. Michael Bernstein, M.D., an eye surgeon and tennis buff who played 6 times a week, was in the prime of life at 54 and married with 4 children when he had an incapacitating stroke. He completed a new neuroplastic therapy, recovered, and was back at work when I met him in his office in Birmingham, Alabama. Because of the many rooms in his office suite, I thought he must have a number of physicians working with him. "No," he explained. "He has a lot of rooms because he has a lot of elderly patients, and instead of making them move, he goes to them. These older patients, some of them, they don't move so well. They've had strokes," he laughed. The morning of his stroke, Dr. Bernstein had operated on 7 patients, doing his usual cataract, glaucoma, and refractive surgeries, delicate procedures within the eye. Afterward, when Dr. Bernstein rewarded himself by playing tennis, his opponent told him his balance was off and that he wasn't playing his usual game. After tennis, he drove to do an errand at the bank, and when he tried to raise his leg to get out of his low-slung sports car, he couldn't. When he got back to his office, his secretary told him he didn't look right. His family physician, Dr. Lewis, who worked in the building, knew that Dr. Bernstein was mildly diabetic, that he had a cholesterol problem, and that his mother had had several strokes, making him a possible candidate for an early stroke. Dr. Lewis gave Dr. Bernstein a shot of heparin to keep his blood from clotting, and Dr. Bernstein's wife drove him to the hospital. During the next 12 to 14 hours, the stroke worsened, and the entire left side of his body became completely paralyzed, a sign that a significant part of his motor cortex had been damaged. An MRI brain scan confirmed the diagnosis. Doctors saw a defect in the right part of the brain that governs movement on the left side. He spent a week in intensive care, where he showed some recovery. After a week of physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy in the hospital, he was transferred to a rehabilitation facility for 2 weeks, then sent home. He got 3 more weeks of rehabilitation as an outpatient and was told his treatment was finished. He had received typical post-stroke care. But his recovery was incomplete. He still needed a cane. His left hand barely functioned. He couldn't put his thumb and first finger together in a pincer movement. Though he was born right-handed, he had been ambidextrous and, before his stroke, could do a cataract operation with his left hand. Now he couldn't use it at all. He couldn't hold a fork, bring a spoon to his mouth, or button his shirt. At one point during rehab, he was wheeled onto a tennis court and given a tennis racket to see if he could hold it. He couldn't, and began to believe he'd never play tennis again. Though he was told he'd never drive his Porsche again, he waited until no one was home, got into a $50,000 car and backed it out of the garage. And I got down to the end of the driveway, and I looked both ways, and I was like a teenage kid stealing a car. And I went to the dead end of the street, and the car stalled. The key is on the left side of the steering column in a Porsche. I couldn't turn the key with my left hand. I had to reach across and turn the key with my right hand to get the car started, because there was no way I was going to leave the car there and have to call home and tell them to come get me. And of course, my left leg was limited, and pushing the clutch was not easy. Dr. Bernstein was one of the first people to go to the Taub Therapy Clinic for Edward Taub's constraint-induced CI movement therapy, when the program was still in its research phases. He figured he had nothing to lose.
This is the end of disc number 4. Please insert disc number 5.